show. To listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 10:59 a.m. And coming up at 11 on the Radio Zine, Kathleen Stevenson speaks with photojournalist and author Dina Stryker about her book, Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution. We'll also hear from our good friends at Truth Dig. Yes, Joshua Shearer speaks with Sarah Burris. And that's all coming up right after these important announcements. Keep it locked.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Yay! This is a great time to clean out those closets and shelves and turn your old books, records, and CDs into cash for community radio. Bring them to KBOO. Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. We're accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Wednesday, August 10th. The sale will be held in mid-August. Stay tuned for details. Please, no home-recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs. And with me by phone this morning is photojournalist, writer, and blogger Dina Stryker. Dina Stryker, welcome to KBOO Radio.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Now, you were born in Philadelphia, but spent most of your adolescence and adult years in Europe. And just to continue on with some of your biography, Dina Stryker began her journalistic career at Agence France-Presse in Rome. She spent 2 years in Cuba, beginning in 1963, late 1963. She spent half a decade in Eastern Europe and a decade in the U.S., studying global survival and writing speeches in the Carter State Department. She wrote the only book that foresaw the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And you might have to pronounce that one for me, Dina.
Une autre Europe, un autre monde.
Thank you. She's also the author of the memoir Lunch with Fellini, Dinner with Fidel, and A Taoist Politics, The Case for Sacredness, which examines the similarities between ancient wisdom and modern science and what this implies for political activism. She also blogs at otherjones.com.
Right. And at opednews.com, where I'm a senior editor.
Today we're going to be talking about her latest book, Cuba, Diary of a Revolution, Inside the Cuban Revolution with Fidel, Raul, Che, and Celia Sanchez. Dina, can you talk about how you came to travel to Cuba in late 1963 and 1964?
Well, as you said, I'd been working at the French news agency in Rome, and naturally, journalists who would be on assignment for anybody in Rome would sooner or later stop by the French news agency office, and there were several of them that had been to Cuba and that came with stories that were totally different from what the mainstream press, whether Italian, French, or American, was publishing. And after a while, I began to get curious about this because I was just beginning in the corporation of journalism. And I wondered whether this corporation that I was joining was on the level, and whether I wanted to be part of it. So I had written a book on the making of the Fellini film, Eight and a Half, which is also a diary, a day-by-day account of the shooting of that film. And several excerpts from that book were published by Paris Match. And I ran by them the idea of doing a portrait of Fidel Castro. And they said, sure, if you can do that, we'll publish it. And that was how I took the money that I was earning from my book on Fellini's film 8 1/2 and went to Cuba. And I went to Cuba on my French passport, since Americans were not allowed to travel there at that time. And I had, of course, dual citizenship.
Did you propose something that was non-political?
Right, exactly. That's it. That was the deal with the with Paris Match. It would be just the person, not politics. Because, of course, nobody was going to publish anything political about Cuba at that time.
And how did you deal with that, since there was so much political involved in the whole Cuban Revolution and all the events that were happening at the time?
Well, I think that most people have heard that Fidel Castro is quite an imposing person. He's not an ordinary person, and so it wasn't really very difficult to focus on his personality. When I finally managed to connect with him after 3 weeks of vain attempts through the Foreign Ministry press office, I subsequently spent another 2 weeks there, during which I met with him 5 times in different settings, when he was doing different things, speaking to different people, etc. So I was able to get a sense of who he was as a person, which is what came out in the article.
And the same kind of philosophy when you were interviewing the other members of the revolutionary group?
Well, that happened in a second trip to Cuba. After the article was published, I had gone back to France and the article was published. And I had a standing invitation to return, because one of the things that I had complained about to Fidel Castro when I was able to speak to him all those various times was that I had not been allowed to leave Havana to see anything of the rest of Cuba. So basically what he said was, you should come back and you'll be allowed to travel. So while I was back in Rome, actually, where I was living at the time, and that was my base, I contacted an Italian publisher and asked him if he would be interested in a book that would explore the famous question, was Fidel Castro a communist before he took power or was he not? And my propos was to interview as many people that had been with Fidel during the revolutionary years and were still with him as members of the government, to find out from each one why they had joined this movement and how they saw it, what they perceived to be its goals. That was how I had this standing invitation in the fall of 1963, and suddenly Kennedy is shot, and after that. So I activated the invitation, and I dealt on the night of the very day that I arrived. Of course, he was Kay, and there was all that talk at the time that Oswald, you know, was suspected of having had ties to Cuba, and they were really glad that he had not been given a visa to Cuba at the time.
It must have been incredible.
It was. And so then they were, you know, very much interested in the focus of my book, and it made it possible for me to meet all the members of the government, which I did over a period of another year or so. Because, of course, there were all things happening all during that time. And so my book chronicles what was going on in Cuba at that time and presents the conversations that I had with each of the members of the government when they occurred. So it's sort of like there are two themes to the book, the present and, you know, perceptions of the past fight and what it meant to them and how they saw the revolution currently when we were talking.
That question about whether they were communists, whether Fidel was a communist when he started the revolution. Why was that so important to people?
Well, communism was a big issue for the United States. And ever since the end of World War II, it had been our focus to defeat communism because we believed, or our leaders believed, that if it was allowed to survive in any other place besides Russia, where it had been, you know, originally started, that it would eventually engulf the entire world, including the United States. So it was the famous domino theory, which was very much in the conversation during the Vietnam War. You may remember that it was imperative that we defeat the communists in Vietnam, because otherwise it would spread, and so on and so forth. So the same applied in spades to Cuba, because it's on our doorstep.
What did you know about Cuba before you went?
Nothing. Literally, nothing at all. But soon, you know, I learned from the people there and from reading. There were a lot of books available when I was in Cuba. They were importing all sorts of books in different languages and from different places. And there was a very big focus on education in general. I believe that it's still the case today. And all through these years, even people who were very anti-communist would admit that Cuba had, you know, an exceptional education system.
Yeah, and you were both young and a woman. Did that present any problems? Did people take you seriously? Were there obstacles around your gender and your age to overcome?
Well, I believe that the press office didn't take me seriously because, as you say, I was both young, I was a woman, and I was unaffiliated. I wasn't sent by anybody. I was completely on my own. And on top of that, they had had many bad experiences with the few journalists that had been welcomed there after they took power. You know, the reports in the West were all very negative, so it was very hard for them to believe that anyone coming there didn't have already an agenda. And I think the fact that I did this on my own, they felt a sort of comradeship with me because, you know, they had done things that were not standard practice, standard operating procedures, and so on. That was very much Fidel's mentality, and also Raul's and Che's. And so someone who undertook this the way I did, I guess I was pretty unique at the time. And being a woman and being young and not bad looking, well, sure, that helped. But I think mainly it was my can-do-ism that got me the trust of Fidel and the others. And because they could tell that I was, you know, I wasn't spouting some kind of line. I didn't come with preconceived ideas. On the contrary, I was there to learn. So, you know, that's not what journalists usually do.
We are speaking with Dina Stryker about her book, Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution. And you mentioned five times interviewing Fidel.
That was when I was first there doing the article. After I came back, I met with him quite a few times. I mean, I didn't sort of tally them up, but they're all reported in the book. The thing is, obviously, while I was interviewing these other people, I wanted to know from him his take on various things that those other people raised. And finally, I needed a final meeting with him before I left to sort of wrap everything up. And that meeting kept being put off and put off and put off because there were too many other things that stood in the way. And during that time, I met quite often with Celia Sanchez, who was his really right-hand person, the closest person to him in terms of his leading the revolution and leading the post-revolutionary government. And I got a lot of very interesting material from talking to Celia several times also went on a trip with her to the provinces where she was driving, and she drove like a maniac, and I was feared for my life several times.
Right.
She's a really, really very special person, and I was sad to hear that she had passed away quite a couple of years ago.
Maybe just a little bit more about Celia, is that how you say it?
Mm-hmm.
A little bit more about her and what she was like as a person.
She was very intense. She chain-smoked, which I think is why she died relatively young. She was totally devoted to this cause, and during the years before they took power, she coordinated the work of the people in the cities, from the Sierra. She also coordinated the help that they got from Cuban exiles in the United States who were sympathetic to what they were trying to do, although, of course, they thought it was going to be, you know, like the usual takeover, just a change of the guard. And then they found out that that wasn't the case, so things turned a bit sour. But she was officially the head of the Council of Ministers. And I would say that very few things happened without her knowing about it during that time. She was a central person to the daily life of the revolution at that time.
And after all those interviews with Fidel, what can you tell us about how you saw him as a person, how, that portrait that you were painting of him?
Full of energy. Full of passion for what he was doing. He was literally ate, slept, and drank the revolution 24/7. That was really the only thing that he was interested in. And I'm not saying that to paint him as a person with a narrow focus. On the contrary, in the context of the revolution, that meant that he was interested in just about everything, from how can Cuba make its own pasta to is there somebody out there in France who knows how to make cheese, and you know, maybe we can import some shoes from Italy for all the children that are going shoeless. He was an avid reader. When I visited his apartment with a French TV crew that was doing a documentary, I saw that his bedroom consisted of a hospital bed that could be raised and lowered into position so that you could read in bed. And there were like 25 books stacked on either side of this metal hospital bed. He was always to learn something new. And in fact, in recent years, I was not at all surprised when I happened on to one of his contributions to the daily press, in which he said that global warming is the world's greatest challenge and our biggest enemy. I mean, the fact that somebody who had devoted his life to a social revolution steeped in international affairs and theory and practice and all that, in the end, he's clear-eyed enough to see that this is the greatest challenge today. I thought that was really quite in tune with everything that I had known about him 50 years ago. I wasn't surprised at all.
And you interviewed his brother, Raul.
Raul, yes, yes.
Who's now
met with
in
Raul
leadership.
A couple of times. Once when he showed up in my hotel room to make an appointment for me to see him. another time when we met in his office for this long conversation. I had lunch with him and his wife at the time. They had a couple of small children. It was, you know, a very domestic situation that I was introduced to there. And well, they drove me home. They drove me back to the hotel after the interview. And at one point, we were driving in a neighborhood that I was not familiar with, and suddenly Raul pointed and said, "That's Che's house. Look there, that's Che's house." it was all very informal.
You get that feeling from reading your book, that just how sort of organic your exploration was.
Yes. And unfortunately, when I went back in 2011, when the Italian version of this book was presented at the film, at the International Book Fair, everything had become a lot more, it wasn't improv at that, no longer was it improv the way it was in the early 60s.
Sort of formalized.
Yeah. And of course, I couldn't get through to anybody. The only person I got through to was a former student of ethnography, whom I tell about in the book, who is now the president of the Writers Union. And he remembered me very well, and we had a nice chat, but it was like 2 days before I was about to leave, and so there was no way I could, that he could help me to get through to other people.
Now, you mentioned that Raul Castro pointed out Che's house mm-hmm. on your little trip. You interviewed Che, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about what that was like.
Well, that was a challenge. That was a really big challenge. Because I'd heard a lot about Che and, you know, how intolerant he was of ignorance. I think that's the best way to put it. He only met with me because Savia said you have to. So it was already, you know, I wasn't really very welcomed in his daily routine. Then I arrived a bit late, so that didn't help matters. Whatever. I found him to be really, really very, very intelligent and cerebral. And I think I gave myself a 6 out of 10 at the end of that interview. But
for holding your own.
It was a very interesting interview, but I won't spoil the reader's discovery of it in my book.
Right, because it did seem like he challenged you quite a bit.
That's right.
So there was this group of 12, and these mm-hmm. are, of course, the people we've just talked about are the most famous. But you did go through and get the others in that group that you could.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Got them all.
Got
mm-hmm.
them all. What kind of general kind of things can you say about that whole group and how they came together, how they did or did not get along, that kind of thing?
Well, first of all, my perception was that they did get along really well, and they often spoke about each other in very warm terms. And that was particularly interesting to get their take on each other, like Carlos Rafael Rodriguez, who was an old communist and held the position of the head of planning, as I recall, or economic development, I don't remember now which one it was, telling me about his take on Che that he had met with in the Sierra when he was a communist bureaucrat, but apparently he visited Fidel's group in the Sierra when they were fighting and had occasion to know Che in that context. And his emphasis was, for example, on Che's great humanity. One of my chapters is called Government All in the Family, because it was kind of like a group of now families, married couples, who had been together all through that pre-revolution period, or the pre-holding of power, taking of power period, and were still together and worked together very well and trusted each other. And it was just a really nice, a very, very nice atmosphere. The women, there were other women like Melba Hernandez, who had played a considerable role during the revolution and was married to the Minister of Telecommunications, who had been a former accountant in a big American company and had left his job when someone was fired for unfair reasons. And, you know, coming from his bourgeois background, joining the movement, and they all had different stories. They all came from different places in the social hierarchy. And when I met with them, say, mostly in 2004 was when I did most of the interviews. They were really like an organic whole that worked together.
Did you mean 1964?
1964, yes. Right. I'm sorry, what did I say?
2004. It's great that you talked about the women, and I just found that part, you know, trying to scope out what it would be like for a woman who was associated with that whole movement, the women that sort of led up the education aspect mm-hmm. of things.
Yeah, how Fidel had an uncanny ability to recognize certain talents in people, and he would pluck somebody from a very ordinary position and put them in charge of projects that one would imagine were way beyond their scope but turned out to be fine. And I think that his boosting of women must have carried through all these years, because when I was there for the book fair, I noticed a number of young women in positions of responsibility who were incredibly sure of themselves while remaining very interested in how they looked and how they dressed. So they had, you know, they combined these two aspects. Cuban women are often very beautiful, and they dress well with taste, you know. And at the same time, they're not afraid to be in a position of authority, and that's really gratifying.
There were a number of events that were happening at the time that you were there that were big events mm-hmm. Affecting the whole culture, and including the water being turned off at Guantanamo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And some issues about cultural conflicts over how certain things should be approached in the film world.
Right. Oh, that was a big, big issue. Went on for months with arguments published in the various newspapers between the old timers, usually members of the old Communist Party, who had a kind of Victorian view of relations between men and women, and were very upset when the head of the Cuban movie industry, who was also in charge of bringing imported films to the Cuban viewership, when they would bring in films by Pasolini or people like that, they brought in a lot of Italian films, and at the time, you know, that was the golden period of Italian cinema, and they wanted everybody to be able to see these films. But then there were these old-fashioned types, I guess, who believed that you couldn't expose poorly educated people to these sophisticated storylines, and that they wouldn't know how to interpret certain things that might make them, you know, change their own behavior and become loose or something like that. It was an incredible polemic in the newspapers. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I guess Fidel was questioned about, they wanted somebody to come down on one side or another, and he had made a famous speech about intellectuals, and the gist of that, or the theme of that speech, was that with the revolution, everything is permitted. Against the revolution, nothing. So he was very adept at supporting the import of foreign films, while emphasizing the fact that what was important was the revolution, and that one shouldn't lose sight of that.
And there was another event during that time that was quite interesting that you got to cover. It was a trial of
right.
Mr. Rodriguez.
Right, a young man who had denounced people in the movement and caused them to be arrested by Batista's police and killed. And then he had managed to get out of the country with the help of some of the people that were actually part of the revolution but belonged to a different group at the time. And finally, he was being brought to justice, you know, 4 or 5 years after the fact. And this was a big deal. both Fidel and the president of Cuba at the time, testified at his trial. The trial, I think, went on for about a week, and there was no way he was going to save himself, but I think it was viewed as something like a way for people to learn, you know, about what it meant to be a member of a revolutionary group, that you don't tattle on your comrades or whatever. It was riveting. It really, really was.
Mm-hmm. And was he eventually killed?
Yeah, I believe he was.
But not while you were there?
I couldn't say.
Oh, okay.
I think after the trial was over, it was out of the news.
Dean Stryker, can you talk about the trajectory of this book, the book that we're talking about, Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution, and what happened when you handed in the manuscript? I guess start with that, and then how it's evolved over the years.
Right. Well, I had been living in Italy for 6 years, and I was fluent in Italian. And I had this contract with an Italian publisher, so it was relatively logical that I would write this book in Italian. And it was 400 pages long, and I got it to him in some way or fashion, you know, even though it was difficult to think for things to go back and forth between Cuba and other places at the time. And then some months later, he sent me his version, his edited version, which was 150 pages, and it read like a series of newspaper articles. And I felt that it was just not fair to the Cubans who had given me all these facilities, and I just thought it didn't do justice to the access that I'd been granted. So I asked the publisher to be able to put back the equivalent of 50 pages in little bits and pieces to make it a little bit more weighty. And he agreed, but by the time I was able to get it to him, he claimed that the publishing schedule would be all out of sync and he couldn't publish it anymore. And by then, it was difficult to find another publisher because of it being a diary. If you're going to publish a diary, you either have to publish it as soon as it's written so it doesn't become dated, or 50 years later, which is what now has happened. So what was then a current event book is now a historical document.
And how did you go about getting it published this time?
That took a long time, took a relatively long time, but actually I had reviewed a book that was published by the same publisher, Tyen Lane. I had reviewed a book on Ukraine for Op-Ed News, and somehow, I guess, when the publisher read my bio and saw that I had these other books, he got in touch with me. So that was really nice.
What are your thoughts on what you know of Cuba today, you know, in light of President Obama's recent visit, compared to that time in 63 when you first went there?
I do worry about how things will go. Because once you open the doors to business, then you lose control of what's going on. You lose control socially of your country. And I can tell you that at the time I was there, I remember Fidel saying once, apropos the blockade, he said, "I wouldn't care if there were no American tourists here for another 50 years. And I suspect that it was because Raul was in charge that this happened, was able to happen. I don't think it would have happened if Fidel had still been in charge. And this is just a perception. I have no, you know, I don't have secret access to Fidel's mind or anything, but I assume that this has been difficult for him. But there have been things in the press, you know, about how he reacted. So I think, put together with what I know of him, it made perfect sense that he would not have been enchanted with the turn that things have taken.
Mm-hmm.
And I can understand it. While I'm glad on the one hand, I do think that it would have been better if we had been able to get good relations with Cuba without having necessarily to open the island to all the things about modernity that many of us, you know, have second thoughts about or not totally enthusiastic about. It's just the way it is.
We're at the end of this interview. Is there anything that we've missed that you think is particularly important to say before we end our interview?
I think I'd like to say a word about the Cuban spirit, which is really very remarkable and is completely in contrast to some of the things that have been written about how the U.S. government dealing with them in the time of the revolution saw them as childish, as irresponsible, just needing a guiding hand, so to speak. My perception of them only a few years later when I was there was they were very, very aware of everything that was going on in the world, very bright, interested, with lots of energy and, you know, grit, too, to continue on with the process that they had started, even though it was difficult. And I found that same thing when I went back in 2011. Lots of energy and positive thinking and so on.
Dina Stryker, I want to thank you very much for speaking about this today on KBOO Public Affairs. And I want to let people know that we have been speaking with Dina Stryker. The title of this book is Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution, Inside the Cuban Revolution with Fidel, Raul, Che, and Celia Sanchez.
So thank you so much, Kathleen. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you.
You too. And can you tell people again where they can read your blog?
OtherJones.com.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was KBOO's own Kathleen Stevenson speaking with photojournalist and author Dina Stryker about her book, Cuba, A Diary of the Revolution, Inside the Cuban Revolution with Fidel, Raul, Che, and Celia Sanchez. Coming up next on the Radio Zine, finally this morning on the Radio Zine, we hear an excerpt from the program Truth Dig with host Joshua Shear speaking with Sarah Burris, reporter for Raw Story, about Donald Trump's current political status and the media's coverage of him. That's going to round out the Radio Zine for Friday, August 5th, 2016. Stay tuned at noon for Moving On. Here's Truth Dig.
Covered the Democratic National Convention together. She was there. We're talking right now about Trump and now that the conventions are over and about the youth vote. And to Twitter, Sarah Burris, and also she writes for Raw Story. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
It's interesting. You've written a lot about Donald Trump now that it seems like the primary season is getting underway. And as it now shifts to the general election, it seems like the deluge is on Trump, Jill Stein. And really, it's like get behind the lesser two evil argument. Let's go forward. What do you think Trump is feeling right now? Because he's been the media has not been good. And as much as they gave during the primary campaign to get him to where he is, it seems like they're finally taking away, right?
Yeah, I think what happened is Trump had a little bit of a false sense of security coming out of the Republican convention. He saw a little bit of a bump in his poll numbers. But then whenever we had the Democratic convention and Hillary Clinton got an even bigger bump, and Trump had just a media firestorm, you know, a deluge of bad press, both during the convention and then after the convention, just the last, 72 hours. It's just been terrible for his campaign. And so I think he had this false sense of security. I think he felt like I can do anything. I can say anything. I'm going to be fine. And then he got the rude awakening this week whenever the new polling numbers came out, and she got an even bigger bump than he did, and his numbers fell, and now he's losing in all of these swing states.
You know, you write about, this is the latest piece you did for Our Story about Jesse Ventura and thinking that Donald Trump is here to destroy the GOP from within, which would be a really interesting, you know, argument. But talk about Jesse Ventura a little bit, and this idea, he's been friends with Trump for about, 25 years, and that he's not dumb, that this is actually a plan, right?
Exactly. Ventura wrote this this op-ed for Time magazine. And it gets a little rambly in some points, but he basically said, you know, that he and Donald Trump worked together to form the Reform Party in the 1990s, and that Pat Buchanan took over the Reform Party and basically used all the money that they had raised to pay off his old campaign debts and wasn't really running as a serious candidate. So the Reform Party, which they were trying to establish as a legitimate third party, just kind of fell apart. And as a result, he thinks that Donald Trump is delivering some payback to the GOP.
It's really interesting about payback to the GOP, because what's interesting to me is that everyone keeps posting things from Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, like their voice is gospel. George Bush said something the other day. They posted that about Trump. And it's interesting, as I watch Trump, despite being such a rabid nationalist, and I watch the convention, the differences between him in my mind and a typical GOP person that they've kind of created over the last few years, certainly the last few election cycles, I don't think he's that far off. And so he is demonstrating really this real disconnect the GOP has, right? I mean, that's why he's been so successful.
Exactly. I think the Republican Party, the typical old school establishment, pro-business, get the government out of your life and just deal with the economics of the country and the military. I think that part of the Republican Party that had been in control for years and years and years, I think that they got into bed with these Tea Party types and the right-wing evangelicals, and just to make sure that they could establish their power after Bill Clinton was elected. And the result has been that they kind of created this, it's Frankenstein. They created this creature, and now they don't know what to do with it, and they can't pull away from those people, because then they're going to lose. There's no way they'll ever win an election again. But at the same time, you saw what happened just Tuesday in Kansas. They had all of the candidates who aligned themselves as being with Sam Brownback, the right-wing conservative governor who has completely sunk the economy. All of those people lost on Tuesday. And that's in the reddest of red states in the country. So you have to see that, like, this is people are seeing the bad pieces of policy that are coming out of the Tea Party, and they're getting worried about I think their country and the policies, and so they're starting to look for other candidates, both Republicans and Democrats.
It's interesting you mentioned Kansas. Brownback had trouble the last time he ran too, and I do. My brother's ex-boyfriend was from Kansas, and his parents voted for Brownback. And you know, I think eventually, because he kept on saying, like, how, you know, he didn't say stupid, because that's mean to his parents. But the fact is, when you keep voting for Sam Brownback, something's wrong. I mean, you know, when you need, because we all need the government from time to time. I mean, that used to be right. I mean, we all need something from the government.
Right. And you see these Tea Party people. I remember back in 2010 when people were chanting, you know, get the government out of my Medicare. It's just that people don't understand what the government does, the state government, the city government. They don't understand that you pay taxes because you care about having the fire department put out the fires. You pay taxes because you want to make sure that your water is clean, unless you live in Flint, Michigan. You pay taxes for all of these really important things, and people see it as going to Barack Obama and his policies, and that's actually not the way that it works anymore. It's state and local governments who take a lot of our dollars and actually put them to work. So,
and activists,
you know,
too.
Exactly.
And countless, because I actually was having that feeling during the Democratic convention when Joe Biden was up there, who
is the example of misogyny to me, that you can dislike Hillary Clinton, but you love Joe Biden because he's not, you know, I mean, he's gotten this rep. And I see, like, the LGBT issue that's brought up a lot, or all these other issues that was highlighted that I was emotional about. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's filmmakers and activists that have been pushing those issues for years. That's not, you know, the vice president. That gets to him eventually, right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's a big piece of activism, right? Where if you, and I think honestly, activism is how the Tea Party took over the Republican Party. When you have people who change the party from within, that's what many of the activists have done with the Democratic Party. We've made it so that in 2004, there were ballot initiatives all over the place, and people had to, Democrats had to come out and say, marriage is between a man and a woman. And now Democrats can finally be like, yeah, we said that because we had to get elected, but the reality is that's ridiculous.
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, but it's still, it's so callous to me. It's an issue that's near and dear. This is the first issue I cared about when I was 8 years old at my first game, you know, LGBT march. And it's so callous to, like, that, you know, to use these people as political. I get that same sense of the DNC was with the LGBT issue specifically. It's like, oh, finally we can actually, these are humans now. Because it's like your platform for a long time was to make the other and everything else. And we still have a long walk to go to. And then my other really big issue that I was really upset about was all of the pandering to the Latino community, like Jesse Jackson, like, we have to treat Latinos with respect. The president of the United States talked about it. And I'm like, wait, you've deported over 2.5 million people, the administration. You've defended the deportation of these minors. And, like, I don't know. So those kind of issues just drive me insane.
I think, though, that especially whenever it comes to the Democratic Party, at the very least, they've been trying to push immigration reform. Both parties really are not that great whenever it comes to the issue, because I think both of them don't know what to do and how to actually pass a bill. And the Republican Party has made it pretty clear that nothing is ever going to pass, regardless of what it is. You could even say, all right, you propose, what was it, the Gang of Eight that Marco Rubio worked with, you know, they came up with a Republican bill for immigration, and even the Republicans wouldn't pass it. I mean, there's just nothing on immigration that's ever going to get passed. And we have these really crappy laws on the books. And, I mean, I really wish that the president would do an executive order or a directive and just be like, I'm telling the Justice Department not to enforce these anymore. But I don't know that that's the way that things work.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I mean, it's a whole very obviously complex issue. Certainly you could say, I mean, there's continuing to do raids. Certainly, I'm going to let our listeners know, because we're at about the 10-minute mark. My guest is Sarah K. Burris. You can find her work at Raw Story, where she's a reporter, and at Twitter at Sarah K. Burris. The Republicans, and all the interviews I've done about immigration, they won't do anything until there's a Republican president, so it looks like a win, because obviously they need Latino voters going forward. So that's been a big hindrance. And again, I think that Obama, it's a slippery, I don't know what he could do, but maybe he could go and make a directive to the DOJ, certainly ICE and Department of Homeland Security, and say, we're going to make this a sanctuary country, because the Republicans already bash him for it anyway, right? I mean, that's the, you know, they're already bashing him as some kind of, you know, sanctuary
president.
Yeah, which is not true.
Exactly. So, and I feel like the advisors for the president should come at him and be like, don't you get it? This is a gift. They're already calling you this, so you could actually do it.
Yeah.
Whereas the Republican Party is now in bed with Donald Trump, and there's no way they're ever going to get Latino voters to support them after, you know, having a major national party leader come out and say that Mexicans are rapists and drug lords. I mean, that's not only wrong, but it's so disgusting and disrespectful. You can disagree on policy issues, but when you attack people like that and try and lump people all in, I mean, it makes me so angry, like really, really horribly angry.
It's interesting. We're getting off topic, obviously, a little bit.
Sorry.
No, it's fine, because this is an issue that's near and dear to my heart, because, you know, my family's, you know, Hispanic. I mean, I have relatives that are at risk because of both President Obama and then soon to be Donald Trump or soon to be Hillary Clinton. We don't know. We have to make sure that this is a key issue. But it's interesting, because illegal illegal immigration, which actually people who came here legally without papers or undocumented, the whole, you know, because you want to be, you know, you don't want to be like, oh, there are illegals and everything else. Like, that's the common rhetoric. But the fact is, it's an acceptable racism. I mean, there's so much racism in this society, but it does become acceptable because it's like, well, we're discussing policy. So we're then going to, you know, and then it's typically, it's not, you know, geared at, right, European immigration. It's not geared at Canadian immigration. It's geared specifically on our southern border. That's what gets talked about. So at that level, it then becomes racist, even though you're talking about a policy discussion, because you're not talking about how safe the border with Canada is, or we have to make sure that there are no Germans coming here, you know?
I don't know if you saw today the big expose that Politico did that I wrote about as well. Melania Trump may have had some sketchy stuff going on with her immigration paperwork. She came out and gave a statement and said, you know, I've always been above board on my my paperwork. Everything's always been legal. But she's given conflicting statements. And so now she's in a position where you're like, either you're lying now or you were lying then. So which one is it?
Yeah, it's you again. You could find Sarah's work. It's Raw Story, and she wrote about this, the Politico piece about Melania Trump. I want to ask, because I want to switch here as we have the last few minutes, because your expertise is also in millennial issues and youth issues, and we've brought you on a couple times to talk about youth vote. And at the DNC, there was a lot of conversations that were happening in bars and on news sites about the young people that were crying, that were emotional about Bernie, and that, and again, people were telling me like, oh, they're just 19, they're stupid, they're et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's been a lot of talk about that. What did you see both in the DNC and generally with young people? Is this seems like a common refrain, right? They're just young, they don't really know any better, and when they're 35, they'll understand about party building, right? This is a classic refrain throughout this entire election.
It's pretty funny because I remember the 2008 election I was like 23 at the time, and it was the exact same kind of thing where, I mean, obviously the youth vote helped Barack Obama win in several states, and then helped him win the national election. So it's one of those things where I feel like the Democratic Party has been ignoring young voters for a long time. The president hasn't, and I feel like that is a big part of it. I think Bernie Sanders didn't realize when he got into it how successful his message was going to be with young people. And then once he saw it become, you know, young people really responding to it, I think he then figured out, all right, I can be a leader and help bring more young people into the process. I think with the Democratic Party, it really depends on the state. I know California totally got overtaken with Bernie Sanders supporters as part of their delegation. And in large part, that is because there were leaders in the Democratic Party in California who have worked in youth politics before. Christine Pelosi, who is Nancy Pelosi's youngest daughter, she and I worked in youth politics together. And so making sure that new people are coming into the party and they're welcomed, they aren't shunned, they aren't treated like, oh, you don't really know what you're talking about, but instead they're welcomed with open arms and people are like, thank God you're here, we've been waiting for you. I think that is a key component to incorporating both Bernie Sanders' message and the concerns of Bernie Sanders voters into the party. You saw some of the platform issues move a little bit. Like, the party platform got a little bit more progressive, and that is all attributed to Bernie Sanders and his supporters getting involved in the party. But it can't stop at the convention. People are going to have to show up at their state conventions and join their state Democratic parties to make sure that the values that Bernie Sanders upheld are, you know, trickle down to the state level too.
And you know, a reminder of that to young voters or everybody out there, because oftentimes we remember elections in every 4 years, and you brought up Flint earlier. I mean, the EPA is toothless. A lot of these, I mean, we were just in Philadelphia. I think the poverty rate there, based on what I was talking to, is about 33%. It's a Democratic-held city. There's lots of key issues that revolve outside these every 4 year presidential elections, that that's when we need really need the people on the ground, right? Is to one, to hold the feet to the fire of the people in power, but to, you know, remind us even on a local issue, even in every one of these cities, there are key issues no matter who's in power.
And you heard that in Barack Obama's speech, too. That is his history. That is who he is. He started as a community organizer and then climbed his way up through the ladder of politics to become president of the United States. And that, and I think in his speech, what he was trying to explain to people is, I know who you are because I am you. I've been there. And you've got to make sure that you take your values, take these Bernie Sanders values and these issues that matter to you, and they have to trickle down to other pieces of politics. It cannot just be the presidency that you fight for. You have to make sure that you're getting these policies passed at the state and local level too.
And the last thing I would leave about that, about Obama's speech, the whole convention for me was like when the speech Bernie Sanders gave or Hillary gave, it's like, I Facebooked it. I was like, you know, it's great. Great speeches all around. But now it's up to us to make sure that, you know, because Hillary made about a million promises. And I'm not that hopeful. I'm doubtful that a lot of them will get done. So now that ends up being left to us. And we have to fix Congress. There's so many things we have to do. So thank you for being there and covering it.
Hey, it was certainly a wild ride. I will say that much. The storm and the crazy weather. That's how crazy it was.
Thank you so much for joining me. My guest has been Sarah K. Burris. You can find her at Twitter at Sarah Burris. You can also find her work at Raw Story. You can read the Melania Trump immigration stuff and the Jesse Ventura Trump destroying the GOP from within. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that was Truth Dig, with host Joshua Shear, speaking with Sarah Burris of Raw Story. And we thank them for sharing that with us. This is KBOO Portland. It's 11:55 a.m. coming up at noon. Stay tuned for, well, the noon headlines. And moving on, a little slice of Americana with your host, the wonderful, the inimitable, the graceful, and what a guy, Don Jacobson. That's all coming up this afternoon on your community radio. Stay tuned.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, August 5th, 2016. Activists from around the world are converging on the city of Montreal, Canada next week for the World Social Forum. Around 20,000 people are expected at the forum, where activists gather to plan, strategize, and network. But dozens of featured speakers have been denied visas by the Canadian government. Organizers are currently petitioning Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to allow the activists to enter for the social forum. More information on that can be found on the website fsm2016.org. That's the initials for the World Social Forum in French, Forum Social Mondial 2016.org. In Chicago today, police have released the dashcam video of the fatal shooting of 18-year-old Paul O'Neill on July 28th. The footage includes the voices of the officers, but does not show the fatal shooting itself. One of the officers can be heard in the video saying, "They were shooting at us too, right?" In fact, O'Neill was unarmed and was shot in the back. The officer who fired the fatal shot was wearing a body camera, but it was not turned on. In Florida, the murderer of Trayvon Martin was punched in the face in a restaurant last night after boasting about his murder of the 14-year-old black child. According to witnesses, the killer, George Zimmerman, who was indicted in 2013 but found not guilty of any wrongdoing, was complimenting a man in the restaurant on his racist tattoos. He was then bragging about being the guy who'd killed Trayvon Martin when another white man came up and punched Zimmerman in the face. A 19-year-old Portland teenager who was featured on the cover of the Willamette Week for facing a year in jail for a small amount of marijuana has had the charges against him dropped. Devontre Thomas is a Native American youth who grew up on the Warm Springs Reservation east of Mount Hood, but ended up at a boarding school for Native students in his junior year of high school. Thomas's case has brought the boarding school under scrutiny. It's located in Salem, was founded in 1880, and is one of the few remaining boarding schools run by the federal government for Native youth. And a Portland court has charged the right-wing blogger who pointed his gun at Black Lives Matter protesters with 21 counts, 10 counts of unlawful use of a weapon, 10 counts of menacing, and 1 count of disorderly conduct. Michael Strickland had been threatening and harassing activists, particularly trans women and women of color, for over a year. But police did not take any action against Strickland until he pointed a loaded gun at a Black Lives Matter protest in early July. That's it for the KBOO News at Noon. For more local, national, and international news, tune in this evening and every weekday evening at 5 p.m. for the KBOO Evening News, produced by volunteer reporters right here in our Southeast Portland studios. You can join the KBOO News team and learn to write, edit, and produce the news yourself. Contact Ani by email at volunteer@kboo.fm. For KBOO News, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood River and the Gorge at 91.9 FM, Philomath and Corvallis at 104.3 FM, and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose, bound to lose, no good to nobody, no good for nothing. Because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this or too that. Songs that run you down or songs that poke fun at you on account of your bad luck or your hard traveling. I am out to fight those kind of songs to my very last breath of air and my last drop of blood. I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down, for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
And I'm Don Jacobson, and the program indeed is moving on. And I'll be here until 1:30 bringing you